The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Parshat Tzav starts chapter 6. Okay, this is the second parsha of Vayikra. We dealt with the other day how the sacrifice could be understood as a divine concession. That really a human being who really loves God, I mean, if you love somebody, then what's the greatest gift you could give to that person you love? You would give yourself. Okay, you would give yourself. You would give your life for the person you love. And the greatest testimony of love is when you're able to give your life up for the person that you love. And so the karbanot is a concession of the divine to allow man to express that desire to give life, his life, to God, so he gives the life of an animal that he owns, right, or that she owns. Okay? Now, Tzav, whereas the Parsha Vayikra deals with various sacrifices of the community, Tzav deals with the responsibility of the Kohanim with those sacrifices mentioned before, and also sacrifices that are uniquely the responsibility of the Kohanim. So, we're just going to go through the various things that are dealt with here, and then we're going to deal with the philosophy of it. So, just wait 10 minutes just to get the background and the structure of this Parsha. The Parsha starts off with, "You command Aaron and his sons," and that's because this whole Parsha is basically the responsibility of the Kohanim, right, the priests, and their involvement in the sacrifice. Okay? The first sacrifice that is dealt with in a Parsha is called the Olah Tamid, the consistent burnt offering. Okay? The consistent burnt offering. It was a burnt offering brought in the tabernacle and in the temple twice a day, one in the morning and one in the evening. Okay? And it is a lamb that they would bring as the sacrifice. And right after that, the Parsha talks about something called Trumat Hadeshin. That in terms of the order of the day, this actually is the first thing the priest would do. Wake up in the morning, go for a nice day of work in the temple, and what is the first thing that you would do in the temple? It's called Trumat Hadeshin, which is, they would draw lots amongst the various Kohanim that were on duty that day, and you would be very excited, hoping that perhaps today you would win this lottery, because you're going to get the chance to do the first mitzvah of the day of the service of God, which is called the Trumat Hadeshin. And what exactly is that? You would put on the special clothing, and you would ascend the altar, okay? The altar had a ramp. The altar is a square-looking building with a ramp to get up to the top of it. And the Trumat Hadeshin means you take a handful of the ashes that are on the top of the altar from all the various sacrifices. You put it in a silver pan. You would then descend from the altar and put it on the east side of the altar. Right? And this is like great. Like very exciting. And there's a lottery. Right? But you go up there and you take off the ashes. Now, all the ashes of the burnt elements aspects of the sacrifice were left on the top of the altar. And when the Kohen would first go up there, he would take that handful, put it in a silver pan, and put it beside the altar on the east side. And then after that, the other Kohanim on duty would go up, ascend the altar, and they would heap up the ashes into a big heap that was called the tapua. Okay? So all the ashes were kind of like gathered together in the center of the altar. At the point where there was an excess, too much for the altar to handle all the various ashes on top of it, then one Kohen would take the surplus, and his job would then be to carry it outside of Jerusalem in a very special place. Now when you think of this, this is the introduction of this incredible service. Remember, we talked about it. The Kohanim are like angels, so to speak. They are wearing clothing which is angelic. And the temple is this house that expresses this intimacy with God, this closeness with God, and the opportunity for man to be a giver and God to be a receiver. Right? We talked about it before. The Torah is, it says in Pirkei Avot on three things the world stands, three pillars. Torah, avoda and gemilut chasadim. Torah, avoda, which is service, sacrifices, and gemilut chasadim, which is loving kindness. Torah is God, so to speak, turning to man. Okay? Giving his Torah to man. And once man has received the Torah, that means that man has now been confirmed as personally adequate. That God has turned to man and sees man befitting to receive the word of God. Torah is a testimony that God relates to man. When God relates to man, he, so to speak, cultivates the human sense of self. And with that sense of self, man can then proceed to avoda, which is man then turning to God. So the Torah is God giving to man, and the sacrifice is man giving to God. Okay? So the sacrifice is this incredible image of God, so to speak, allowing himself to become a mekabel, a receiver, and man is the giver. Okay? This is an incredible level. So we talked about how the tabernacle is this incredible level, elevation of humankind to that level of so godlike that man is like a god who is the giver, and God is, so to speak, in this relationship like a human being, a receiver. Right? And this is a lofty image of the divine love for humankind. In the light of all that, recognize what is the first service of the day. It's basically, in crude terms, taking out the garbage. Right? I mean, that's the mitzvah. You go up there, and they would take this ash. And I mean, this is it. I mean, you can imagine you're really being, you know, cultivated. You're going to be a Kohen. And what an opportunity to be a Kohen. And look at these garments and look at where you're working. And you're working in such close proximity to the divine. The Shekhinah permeates. The divine presence permeates the entire tabernacle. And so, yeah, fantastic. And what's the first mitzvah you're going to do? It's taking out the garbage. Right? It's very, very strange. But it has two qualities. It has, number one, the truth is, in a love relationship, it really begins when your beloved says, take out the garbage. Right? That's really where it begins, believe it or not. Right? That's where it begins. You see, you know, when we're at Sinai, you know, Cafe Sinai, and we were going out, and we got engaged, and we were staring madly into each other's eyes, that was really wonderful, that face-to-face experience. At Sinai is really wonderful. But interesting to realize that all that lofty ideals, all that vision of closeness and love is really ultimately expressed, right? The day after the marriage when you say to your beloved, could you please take out the garbage? And at that point they say, no, why should I take out the garbage? Right? That's the funny thing about this, that in Judaism we have a principle. Great people seek to do small things in great ways. That's a great person. And that's a great testimony of love. Love isn't when, you know, once a year you go out and buy your beloved some anniversary gift. Love is much more demonstrated in those little things of the day, of those responsibilities. And therefore, on one hand, we're a little overwhelmed. Because the day of sacrifice, you know, this day of incredible demonstration of love starts off with something that really is quite shocking. Right? Seems demeaning. I mean, this is what I'm going to do. I've been chosen. I'm a Kohen. Lucky me. Close proximity to God. And the first demonstration of my relationship closeness with God is to take out the garbage. Right? And yet that's it. Right? So the service itself, a demonstration of the human love for God, actually starts with that which seems like menial tasks. But that's really life. That's really love. It starts right there. And also starts with humbleness. Because, of course, it's incredibly humbly. I mean, you have to appreciate, you know, with great grandeur, the Kohen would ascend the altar with this silver pan. You know, and we're all watching this whole thing without knowing what, you know, the first, you know, the initiating service of the day, and you know, ta 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 ta, and everyone's watching with awe of this momentous beginning of the service of God, the demonstration of human love for God. And what does he do? He takes the ashes and puts them in the silver pan and walks down. Right? It's overwhelming, and yet that's what's so beautiful about it. Right? That love begins with those very small things. The demonstration of that relationship with God starts with the very small things and starts with humbleness. Okay? Now, after the Trumat Hadeshin, then they would do the Ola Tatami, which is the complete burnt offering. And of course, again, the complete burnt offering starts the day of service, and it ends the day of service. The day of service is surrounded by complete nullification. Complete nullification. We take this burnt offering, the burnt offering is the complete nullification of ourselves. That is an incredible demonstration of love when you're willing to give yourself completely over to your beloved. Right? And that's what is expressed in the Ola Tamid. Right? The Ola Tamid. Now, the Parsha continues to talk about the mitzvah that there shall be a constant fire on the altar. Now, on the top of the altar, now the altar was really quite big, so on the top of the altar are three arrangements of fire, meaning three arrangements of wood. Here. This is the altar. And here you have the ramp that the Kohen would ascend. If he would take the ashes, he would then descend, go down ramp number 8, and put it over here on the east side. Okay? Now, over on the top of the altar, over here is the tapuach, right, which is the ashes that are piled into the middle. And every morning, they would pile them into the middle, and the excess they would take out outside of Jerusalem. And then on top of it, you have these three orders of fire. You have which the larger fire, and it was here that the various sacrifices were burnt, or the aspects of the sacrifices were burnt. And over here, we have another fire. And this fire is, from this fire, the Kohen would go up, take the fire, and then bring it into the holy, where you had the golden altar for the incense offering. Okay? And then over here, any place was this constant fire. Okay? But you had a mitzvah to keep going all the time. Now this fire, you have to realize, must be ignited always, and therefore when the Jewish people were walking through the desert carrying their portable tabernacle, this fire was still lit. And the fire stayed lit for 100 years. We're talking about the 4 years in the desert and 60 more years into Jerusalem. That was the original fire ignited by by Aaron. What? No, because it didn't get to Yerushalayim right away. When they got to Israel, they didn't go right away to Yerushalayim. It was only in time. No, it's in Israel. Okay. Right, that's certainly the connection. Okay, that's certainly the connection. But the Ner Tamid is really more connected to the menorah. So it also had a light that was always going. Okay? So, the mitzvah is that every day they would have to bring, twice a day, two pieces of wood to put on the large fire. That was a mitzvah. And then a heavenly fire would rest on the altar and consume. Now you have to appreciate that according to our tradition, they would actually see a fire come out of nowhere from above and descend and consume their offerings. And everybody saw that. Right? Well, the fire that would descend was in the image of a lion in the first temple. In the second temple, the image of the fire came down as a dog, demonstrating that it was not completely a desirable temple. It did not really have the divine presence within it. Okay? That was part of its miracle. That was just part of its miracle. Okay. Then our parsha talks about the minchat chinuch, which was a initiation offering, a meal offering of flour to initiate the service of the kohanim. Then there was something called the minchat chavatim, which was brought twice daily. Again, it's made out of flour. And what would happen, you take this mixture, it would be half offered in the morning, half offered in the afternoon. And this was an atonement. Now the question is, an atonement for the high priest. The high priest would bring this flour offering. And the question is, why would he bring a flour offering as an atonement? So the Abarbanel says, number one, to show you that to be atoned, right, to atone for others, you yourself must be atoned. And therefore the Kohen, before he could do the service for other people throughout the day, would have to atone for himself. Also to encourage sinners to come, that even the high priest is willing to share and demonstrate that he also fails and also needs to be atoned for. And why was it a flour offering when we learned that a flour offering was only for the poor people? And this was so the poor person would not feel embarrassed. Rabbi Barbanel says that even the high priest in his atonement would only have to bring this, and therefore he would not feel embarrassed that in only bringing a flower offering. The parsha then talks about Shlemi Toda. Last parsha talks about the offering of thanksgiving, but it talks about a free will thanksgiving. Our parsha also deals with obligatory thanksgiving offerings, meaning if you were in jail and you got out of jail, right, so then you would bring thanks to Hashem that you got out of jail alive, according to certainly in those days, what jail means, probably even today too. Or if you got over a serious illness, or if you were traveling in the sea and you safely made it back, or traveling in the desert and safely made it back, you were obliged to bring a thanksgiving offering, which in our days is similar to what's called Birkat Gomel, which is when something dangerous has happened to you and you, thank God, have been saved, so you would go to the Torah and you would say Birkat Gomel. Okay? And this thanksgiving offering could either be a bullock, a lamb, or a goat, and you would put your hands on it instead of confessing, which was the procedure of a sin offering, you would put your hands on it and you would give thanks to God for being saved. It comes with 40 challos. You actually bring not only this animal, but 40 challos. 30 of them are made of 3 different types of unleavened bread, matzah, and another 10 are made out of leavened bread. Okay? Then the Kohen would, after they slaughter the animal and cut it into the various pieces of meat, then the Kohen would bring pilot with 4 challos, and they would do some kind of ceremony called the tnufa, which is they would wave it back and forth and up and down. And then part of it was burnt, part of it was eaten by the Kohen, and part of it was eaten by the owner or any other Jew who was in a state of purity. Okay? Now, you have to realize that there are fundamentally 3 types of sacrifices. An ola is completely burnt. A chatat, a sin offering, is partially burnt and partially eaten by the Kohen. And a shleimim offering, a peace offering or a thanksgiving offering, is partially burnt, partially eaten by the Kohanim, and partially eaten by the owner or any Jew. Any Jew. Now, the oral tradition says that all the other sacrifices in the future will be nullified except this one. Because the shleimim offering is the highest mode of divine service. Okay, the highest mode of divine service is the thanksgiving offering, which is consumed by the altar, consumed by the Kohen, and also consumed by the Jew. The parsha then continues to bring in various laws as to eating restrictions. You have to have the right intention when you bring this offering that you intend to eat it within the restricted amount of time. Okay, you couldn't like just take it and eat it whenever you wanted, but the various offerings had various time limits within which it must be eaten, and the leftover would then be burnt. Okay? The parsha then brings the prohibition for eating various fatty parts of the animal, the prohibition of eating blood of an animal, and it ends off with the 7 inaugurational days. Right? Now they're ready to inaugurate the Mishkan, the tabernacle, and the Kohanim. Moses personally dresses each of the Kohanim in the morning and undresses them at night. Moses personally dismantles the Mishkan every single day and reassembles it in the morning. And he anoints all the vessels, he anoints the Kohanim. And they bring, during those days, the various sacrifices. Moses acts like the Kohen Gadol and shows the Kohanim how to do the service. Right? It was only during those 7 days that Moses acted like a high priest and showed them how to do the whole thing. And that then brings us to the next parsha, which is called the 8th, which is the 8th day of the inauguration, because on the 8th day was the first day that now the Kohanim would do the service. Okay? Alright, so now let's go back to the whole thing and let's understand it philosophically. The name of the parsha is Tzav, which means command. When we explore the parsha carefully, it's a very strange parsha. Very strange parsha. Okay, this incredible expression of human love for God, which God allows us to express through service. Okay, we're a little overwhelmed by the introduction of the day. So the introduction of the day is taking out the garbage. It seems like belittling work. The introduction of the day is the burnt offering. But then again, when you think about it, it makes sense. And if someone were to say to you, over there is a house of sacrifice, right? Well, then you would understand, right? In that house, there's sacrifice. Because sacrifice means sacrificing yourself, sacrificing your dignity, sacrificing your sense of power. I mean, isn't that what sacrifice means to people? I mean, there's not too many people in the world that like the word sacrifice. Do you follow that? Right? You know, it's not it. Well, people think sacrifice is really not a fun thing to do. It's letting go. It's giving up. It's surrender. And it's understandable why some people would actually be very motivated by sacrifice. Why would they be motivated by sacrifice? Because in fact they're very weak people. In fact they're really quite losers in the world. And therefore since they're weak, since they're losers, they must create some kind of religion that justifies their weakness and even sanctifies their weakness. As we once mentioned the name of Nietzsche. Nietzsche saw that there were two types of people in the world. There were the weak ones and the strong ones. And the strong ones would do what they want. But the weak ones, they created a religion, a plot of morality, to justify their weakness, right? To sanctify their weakness and make the strong ones feel guilty that they're strong. And Nietzsche said, who were the forerunners of this plot against mankind? It was the Jews, right? And it was the Christians that carried it out. In other words, yeah, service to God, sure, that's good for people who are weak. They can't make it in this world, right? They're not going to be amongst the survival of the fittest. So you create a philosophy, an ideological position that sanctifies the fact that you're a nothing, right? You realize you're a nothing, what? Exactly. It is a philosophy that most people see a person who is somehow aspiring towards a religion must be because really they're weak, really they didn't make it, really they're losers, and what they do is to justify their position. Right? They create an ideological vision that makes them feel good that they're so weak. Right? Because they really have nothing, so therefore for them sacrifice, right, is now the ideal. Right? As if you really had something in the first place. So really the introduction of the service would make a lot of sense to most people today. They say, oh sure, that's what service is all about. You know, showing, sanctifying weakness. Right? Justifying weakness. Taking your problems and translating them into actually they're really virtues. Your vices of weakness, right? Lack of human dignity is now justified as an incredible sacrifice to God, and you're really very high because you're so low. So when we walk in the temple, it would only feed the preconceived notions of most people as they witness divine service. But what then continues on in the day? What happens is something really quite weird. I'm expecting to walk into a house of sacrifice. I see the introduction of the day, complete nullification, taking your animal and just burning it on the altar, and that's what religion's all about. And then this other person comes in, and it's a sin offering, and of course, sin offering, yeah, we know, right? And they take part of it, and they sacrifice it. And then the Kohen begins to feast on steak and burgers. I mean, and you're a little overwhelmed. Right? The high priest, who really probably like the lowest life of them all, who really had to justify his weakness, right? The high priest and all the other priests, right? These people dedicated their lives completely to religion and service. What are they doing? They're sitting there eating steak. Right? And you're a little overwhelmed. And then another person comes in with a Thanksgiving offering. And you think a Thanksgiving offering, you would be a complete burnt offering. And to your surprise, not only is it not a complete burnt offering, but part of it is burnt, but part is eaten by the Kohen, and the other part is eaten by the owner and any other Jew, right, who's in a state of purity. So, can you imagine trying to convince someone in the center of New York, listen, come with me to the house of sacrifice. Oh, no, 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 please, I don't want to go. And this guy's got one cow, right? One cow. He said, come on, come on, to the house of sacrifice. No, no, don't take me. You finally schlepped the guy, and what does he, to his shock, see in the house of sacrifice? It's a sacrificial steakhouse. The guys are sitting there eating and enjoying themselves and partaking of, right, this feast. And you say, what's going on over here? How is it that in the house of sacrifice these Jews are feasting? Doesn't make any sense. So, I think it could be understood with a parable. The Shlemi actually is the ultimate demonstration of sacrifice in Judaism. It will be the only sacrifice that will be left. All the other sacrifices will be nullified, the old tradition said. And the only one will be this one. This is some incredible sacrifice. So what's incredible? You would think a sacrifice, the most incredible sacrifice, was which one? The burnt offering. And yet to our shock and surprise, the highest sacrifice is the one that I'm eating and the altar is eating, so to speak, God is eating. That's the highest sacrifice. Why? So you see, it's like a person who loves a king. And out of incredible love, puts their whole heart and energy in preparing a feast for the king. And even though the king doesn't need this feast, even though the king might not even be hungry, the king lovingly opens the door and says, thank you for your meal. And the king becomes a receiver from his beloved subject, who is now offered the opportunity to be the giver. Right? And then the king says to his subject, please, please join me at my royal table in this feast that you have prepared. Okay? This is what the Shlemi is all about. To our very shock, this sacrifice, which is a thanksgiving to God, somehow returns on us and we partake in it and enjoy it. It's similar to the concept in Kabbalah called the Or Yashar and the Or Chozer. The direct light and yet the returning light. You see, people do not realize that to give in a funny way is to receive. In a funny way is to receive. Giving is receiving the greatest opportunity in the world. There's a piece in the oral tradition that says that more than the host does for the guest does for the host. Say, right? You think you're doing a big favor to this poor person who you invite for a meal to your table. And we learn and we teach that that poor person is doing more for you than you're doing for them. Because he has offered you the possibility to give. The greatest possibility to be like God. To be a giver. And in being a giver, in a funny way, you have received. Strange. Right? Very strange. And you can't give in order to receive. Right? That's the funny thing about it. And so there's a piece from the oral tradition, from Perkei Avot, that says, open your house wide to the poor. Okay? Open your house wide to the poor. So the word wide is ravacha. And the Nefesh HaChaim explains, you know, the word ravacha also means profit. So therefore, don't read, open your house wide to the poor. Open your house up to profit for the poor. The Nefesh HaChaim says, you don't realize. To give to the poor is your profit. So, sacrifice in Judaism is gain. To have the opportunity to show love to your beloved at the utmost level actually returns to you and you receive an incredible, profound pleasure from the giving and the, so to speak, receiving of God from your giving. Now, the Gemara says something very interesting. It says, if an idol worshiper brings a sacrifice to the temple, you receive it. There's an opinion that says that if this idol worshiper comes and says, I would like this to be a thanksgiving offering, which we know the law is, partially eaten by God, so to speak, the Kohen and the people, realize that he really meant to say he wants to bring a burnt offering. Do you understand? He walks in and says, I want to bring a thanksgiving offering. And we're instructed to understand that to mean a burnt offering. You accept his offering and you completely burn on the altar. And apparently they did this and the idol worshiper in no way got upset. So that means that really, this is what he intended. When he said, I want to bring a Thanksgiving offering, you should understand that that really means, in your language, a burnt offering, and just take his offering and burn it completely. Right? And that was the law. That's actually the law that Rambam brings down. That's really strange. I mean, why? Why do we assume that when he brings a Thanksgiving offering, he actually means a burnt offering, and that it should be completely burnt? You see, as we talked about it before, the idol worshiper really does not have any understanding of a relationship with God. The idol worshiper has no understanding of non-duality, the possibility for love with God. And therefore, the idol worshiper's religion, his religious expression, is complete nullification. And therefore, his Thanksgiving offering is expressed through complete nullification. That's all he understands. Right? That's all he understands. He understands that the way to God is complete nullification. However, what he cannot understand is the paradox of love. How surrender is gained. How surrender in itself merged in the experience of love. See, that's the mystery of love. Love is the unity of two completely opposing forces. To be in a situation of love for someone, you have to simultaneously be surrendering to your beloved, and yet, not too much surrender, because then you no longer exist, and then there wouldn't be a relationship. So you must simultaneously establish a sense of self in surrender. And that's a strange thing in love. You are simultaneously feeling completely nullified to your beloved. You're willing to completely give over, and yet simultaneously you establish a sense of identity. And there's a contradiction there, but that's the irony. That's the beauty of love. That it can incorporate these two completely opposing forces at the same time. Now the idol worshiper doesn't understand that. For the idol worshiper, there are only two ways. There's either the religious way, or there's denial. Either there is surrender, or there is self. If it's surrender, then it's surrender. And if it's self, it's denial, it's atheism. Okay? You follow this. The idol worshiper doesn't have this understanding of non-duality. He doesn't have the understanding of the Ein Sof as an expression of love. And love is this mysterious ability to give place and space to other, cultivate other, and yet other is completely still in surrender and oneness with the lover. Right? No, this is beyond the idol worshiper. Beyond the idol worshiper. And therefore, the idol worshiper only sees an eternal either-or situation. Either it's surrender, or it's self. Right? Either it's surrender to God, a religious service, or it's self, which is a denial of a God, an atheism. And yet Judaism is this very strange religion based on the possibility for love of God. And that surrender is itself an expression of self. And they're used simultaneously. The Tanhuma brings down that the idol worshippers came to Bilam and said, why didn't God ask us to bring a sacrifice? And Bilam said, you didn't want to accept the Torah, you can't bring a sacrifice. Right? He who accepts the Torah is he who can really bring a sacrifice. See, what is a sacrifice? A sacrifice in Judaism is God giving you the possibility to give to God, so to speak. And in that is your gain. So, the day starts off with a complete surrender, and yet that's only an introduction to an even higher mode of sacrifice, which is that you and the king, so to speak, share in its nourishment, so to speak. And then in a funny way, your sacrifice returns to you, partially returns to you. Your surrender, in a funny way, establishes a sense of self in relationship. Right? And that's what the Shlemim is all about. So a person would walk into the temple, and they would expect to see burnt offering, surrender, nullification. And yet that's only an introduction to an even higher offering, where the Jew realizes that his offering, in a funny way, returns back to him, and he shares in the experience. In the giving, you are actually simultaneously receiving and enjoying. Okay? But, just like we talked about before, in the prayer, Judaism says that when you're doing a Shemona Esrei, although the goal of man and the goal of Judaism stand before Hashem, really, it's introduced through bowing. But the bowing is in order to stand up. Right? Important principle in Judaism. When we say Baruch Atah Hashem, we bow our knees, Baruch, we bend Atah, and we stand before Hashem. And yet the surrender is in order to stand before God. In Judaism, the nullification of self is to set the stage for a healthy sense of self. You have to be prepared to surrender to your beloved in order that your assertiveness of self will be within the proper context of oneness with your beloved. And so too over here, the service is introduced through a surrender, and yet the surrender is actually only an introduction to an even higher mode of love, where you and the divine, so to speak, are both sharing in the eating of this. Right? The eating of this. So, the irony of this whole parsha, Tzav, commandment suggests sacrifice. Right? And yet, one would expect to walk into a house of sacrifice and see sacrifice. And yet, strangely enough, what they see is a sacrificial steakhouse. That in a very strange way, this sacrifice ends up to be a human feast. Right? And your letting go of the physical world is in order to then receive it in a manner that it will not separate you from Hashem. That's the amazing thing. Now, the amazing thing that goes even further than this is Judaism considers the eating of the sacrifices as part of an atonement process. That itself is even more unbelievable. That the eating is also part of the atonement. I would understand the atonement is the burning of it. And somehow God says, okay, you can eat now. But actually the eating itself participates and contributes to the atonement. Let's understand how. Remember, how is it that a person would come to sin? It's because they gave too much credibility to their physical being. Because my body suggests that I am actually separate of God. Independent. And I've got to, so to speak, save my skin in order to save myself. And in a funny way, people think to be selfish is survival. And yet in Judaism, it's to be selfless, which is to survive. When a person is selfish, they feel so lethargic. They feel empty. They feel meaningless. And yet when a person is giving and loving, they feel fulfilled. When they move out of their particular borders, that's when they discover themselves in a funny way. So selfishness is actually a forfeiting of self, and selflessness is the only way to really recognize the power of self. Right? The power of self. So sin is based on, God wants me to do this. My body, which tells me, you're independent. Right? You're your own person. To defy the will of God is a statement of yourself. No. Just like kids. A kid feels that the only way that they can express self is by saying no. But we believe that the highest expression of self is when you have the power to say yes. When you have the power to say yes. When you love somebody, even though your body says we're two, your soul says we're one. And when we fight, and when my beloved says, please, will you take out the garbage, my body would say, say no and show that you're no. You know, you're no lowlife, you know. You're your own man. You'll do when you want to do it. But your soul says, that's an illusion. If you realize that you're one, then by saying yes, you'll testify that you are actually one. So a sin is based on a moment of insanity. Just like when two lovers fight, it's a moment of insanity. It's based on this illusion that we're separate and we're actually fighting for some assertion of self and identity. By showing us and rebelling to each other and saying no to each other, rather than saying yes to each other, and overcoming the body, which suggests our separateness, and tap into a higher experience, which is actually our oneness. That's what happens when a person sins. When a person sins, they've actually invested in their body more than their soul. Now, they've invested in what the body testifies, which is separateness, an identity of the function of me in my body, rather than identity of the function of me in relationship with an other, right? Who's saying yes to the will of other. Now, that's why we bring a sacrifice. Because the sacrifice is the burning of that flesh. And an overwhelming, granted, an overwhelming realignment of consciousness in a recognition that the body is not as solid as in concrete as you think it is. And the physical, just being put into this fire, which was just lit with perhaps a real match, is consumed in seconds. And it's that, in that astonishing vision, that one once again reawakened to the eternity of soul. Right? That's when people have to begin to recognize a different reality. It's when you come so close to death that you have to redefine the essence of life. And you begin to realize that it couldn't be my body, because if it is, it's over in a second. But I sense that my soul, I sense that my identity goes beyond my body. And therefore, when a person sins, it's trying to establish identity by saying no, by supporting body. And when a person does a mitzvah, it's establishing identity by saying yes and entering into a relationship with God. So it makes sense. You take this body, you take the physical, and you burn it. A tikkun, a fixing, right, of the amount of energy and concern and consciousness you gave to the physical over the spiritual. But then the question is, why would you eat it? Right? It would make more sense that the sin offering would be completely burnt. And that would be the atonement. The atonement is putting credibility into the physical, and therefore letting go of the physical, burning the physical, right? In recognition of a deeper value, which is the spiritual. So why then would you eat the physical? And how could then eating of the physical be part of the atonement? What we have here is really such a deep idea. Because people do not understand that as much as the body suggests an illusion of separateness, it is crucial in suggesting the reality of distinction. The body is also very important. Because without the body, then we think everything is one and there are no distinctions. Love is a oneness that includes distinction and yet one. That's the miracle of love. Love is one and one is one, and yet I'm not one the same as you. So whereas the body has a certain negative element to it, which suggests that we're separate, right? And it damages the unity of love. It also has another very important quality, which it qualifies the distinction of our identity. I'm not you and you're not me, and yet we're still one. So there's an aspect of the flesh that must be burnt, but there's an aspect of the flesh that must be reconsumed. There's an aspect of the flesh and the physical that is granted destructive. There's an aspect of the physical that is sustaining and nourishing. You've got to be very careful to recognize the two. We want to nullify the hard shell that the physical suggests, the hard separation, but we want to reconsume and reintegrate and appreciate the nourishing quality of the distinction that the physical world also brings into the world. You see, I've seen it before. There are certain people that when they do tshuva, in the process of their tshuva, on the altar of their sacrifice goes their willpower. On the altar of their sacrifice goes their desires, their love for life, their love for this world too, and what it can offer you. And that you'll have to do an atonement on. There will come a time where people will realize that they will have to atone for their atonement. Right? Because in the process of doing tshuva, right, they threw into the fire everything that was beautiful and important about this physical world. When a person does a sin, there's a negative quality of rebellion, but there's still to be sifted out of it the positive quality of willpower. You have will. If you could take the will to transgress the will of God, now take that. Don't lose that. There was something really good in that too. Don't lose that. Reunite with it. And use that will to perform the mitzvahs of God. You follow that. In the process of trying to do tshuva between the broken relation between you and your beloved, right, you end up throwing everything into the fire, and then you have no more drive. Right? You have no energy. And you end up a wimp at the end of this whole tshuva process. And that's the saddest thing. And this is so remarkable. Part of the atonement is to be consumed by the fire. You must burn the physical and see what's destructive about it. And yet you must reconsume the physical and see what's sustaining about it. Now, the sinner is not allowed to do that. The Kohen does it for you. The Kohen is your representative, so to speak, the human representative that demonstrates to you that there's an element of your drive that must be reconsumed by the humankind. Right? We do not want to burn on the altar also the positive quality of sin, which is you made a choice, you took action, you were seeking to express self. There's nothing wrong in Judaism to assert self. It's just, why does everybody think that to assert self is through war? To assert self is higher through love. Why does everybody think that to assert self is by saying no? When there's an even greater assertion of self, when you know you could have said no, but you choose to say yes. So there's something very powerful in sinning, something very important, that can still be recycled. After all this life of sin, so to speak, does that mean everything that you did in your life is meaningless? And there's nothing that can be consumed about the whole deal? Yes, there's all that willpower that went into all that sin. There was all that rebellion that was an incredible desire to assert self. Now take that power of asserting self and assert self through relationship with God rather than through rebellion to God. It helps throw out the whole thing with it. Very crucial to understand this. Something that I have to say, unfortunately, I've seen people who, after a certain life of sin, feel that their entire life was meaningless and there's nothing about it. All they have to do is take the entire past and throw it onto the altar and may it be a burnt offering. Right? I'll just burn the whole thing up. And yet the amazing thing is no. Right? Part of the atonement process. If it's not eaten, then you haven't finished the atonement. Right? Because part of the process is destroying, but part of the process is refining. What you're doing is you're refining your will, not destroying it. And therefore, you're refining the physical, not destroying it. You're destroying the aspect of the physical that testifies to separateness, that encourages asserting self through rebellion, through denial, through transgression. But you are refining the physical to maintain that sense of self, which then could be understood through a unity of distinction, and yet unity nonetheless. So, in Judaism, eating is like a sacrifice. When the person is sitting at a table, you're not supposed to sit on a table, because the table is like an altar to God. And you're sitting there, and you're about to eat the food, and according to Judaism, eating is like a sacrifice. And, well, that doesn't make any sense. Right? Sacrifice is fasting. In Judaism, no, sacrifice is sitting there and eating. How could that be? Well, a sacrifice means taking the physical and using it, not nullifying it, but using it within the context of a relationship with God. If a person eats of a meal at a table where no words of Torah have been said, then that sacrifice is considered to be a sacrifice of dead corpses. That's a disgusting sacrifice. But if there are words of Torah set at the table, then this is actually a sacrifice. Why? Because then the food has been used immediately. The energy that it has given me has been used to learn some Torah, to enter into a relationship with God, to enter into love. I use that power of self that the physical nourishes me towards within the context of love, within the context of relationship with Hashem. Okay. So, there's actually a Gemara that suggests that in the future, all those people in the world that thought the only thing they could bring to God was a burnt offering will be punished. Right? Because the highest offering will be the offering of the thanksgiving, where you realize that it's partly God's and it's partly yours. That's the highest thing. The highest level is when mankind will realize that it's not an either-or situation, surrender or self. love, real love, is the mystery of the unity of self and surrender. This weird balance between self and surrender. So, when a person walks into the house of sacrifice of the Jewish people, they will be overwhelmed. They'll be overwhelmed by the honor that man gains through his sacrifice. They'll be overwhelmed looking at the Kohanim dressed in beautiful, majestic clothing, when you would think sacrifice should be in these pauper clothing, you know. And yet he's wearing gold, he's wearing silver, right? He's wearing jewels. And it'll be fascinated to see that in the house of sacrifice, not only is this are the Kohanim decked out in the finest clothing of the world, of the physical world, they are feasting, right? The feast of the world. And yet it's in the house of the sacrifice. But to get to that lofty level, to get to that level of self, it must be within the context of the surrender. So the introduction of the service is the surrender of the burnt offering, but that's only an introduction. Just as the bowing in the Shemona Esrei is only a preparation to stand, but to stand with humbleness. And that the standing should in no way then imply separation from God, but a whole new level of oneness and love. Okay? Whole new level of oneness and love. So this is the house of the Jewish people. The house of sacrifice. The giving to God, in a funny way, is the highest level of the receiving of man. And man in the house of giving to God is receiving the garments of jewels and is receiving the feast of this world.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.